Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Frederick Clarkson, who looks at the Tucson shooting rampage and the toxic political climate in the U.S., which he believes has contributed to the increasing danger of right-wing domestic terrorism. Sherman Malone of the aid group Haiti MaryCare, who talks about the impact last year's earthquake and subsequent cholera epidemic have had on the nation's impoverished rural and urban population. And investigative reporter David Lindorf, who discusses President Obama's appointment of several conservative Democrats to his administration and why he believes a move to the right won't be politically popular. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Soaring global prices for sugar, grain, and oilseed have increased food prices to historic highs, surpassing the 2008 levels that sparked food riots in Haiti and Africa, where dozens of people were killed. The Food Prices Index, developed by the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, shows the prices for basic food staples like cereals and meat have risen for six straight months. FAO economist Abdelreza Abosain warned of even higher food prices driven by drought conditions in Latin America and record floods in Australia. According to the Guardian newspaper, food prices could level off in coming months since many poor nations had good harvests in 2010. Meanwhile, the price of rice, a staple food throughout Asia, has remained stable. But the massive flooding in Australia could drive world sugar and wheat prices higher, since Australia is a major food commodity exporter. In the Philippines, Catholic bishops have threatened to excommunicate politicians and activists who support a pending reproductive rights bill in the national legislature, which promotes the use of contraceptives like the pill, IUDs, and condoms. In his Christmas message, Bishop Nereo Ochimar, president of the Philippines Catholic Bishops' Conference, equated the reproductive health bill with terrorism. According to the Interpress Service, support for the reproductive health bill has surged on social and peer networking sites. Activists sponsored excommunication parties, and the large turnout at these events demonstrated a high level of resistance to the hardline tactics of Catholic bishops. In an increasingly tense political environment, anti-choice protesters in Manila blocked a group of students, poor mothers, and community activists from going to a prayer vigil in support of the reproductive health bill at the city's largest Catholic cathedral. Recent public opinion surveys in the Philippines found that 71% of Filipinos favor the reproductive health legislation, and three-quarters of the Filipino people favor family planning education in public schools. After years of papering over budget deficits, the state of Illinois has agreed to raise tax rates on corporate and personal income and increase the tax on cigarettes by $1 a pack. Currently, the state of Illinois faces one of the worst budget shortfalls of any state in the country. Without these tax hikes, the state of Illinois faces a potential $15 billion budget deficit this coming spring, nearly 45% of the state's general fund. The tax deal, backed by Governor Pat Quinn, would boost the individual income tax to 5.25% and was endorsed by bondholders. Other large states like California and New York face similar budget crises, and newly elected Democratic governors have promised steep budget cuts. According to the liberal think tank, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, states now face over $130 billion in budget deficits. Illinois' ongoing budget crisis is inflicting real damage on the social safety net. According to a statewide survey, half of all community agencies have cut services to the needy, and more than a quarter of all service providers have curtailed social programs. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The shooting rampage by Jared Lee Loeffner in Tucson, Arizona on January 8th, which left 6 people dead and severely wounded U.S. Representative Gabrielle Gifford and 13 others, has sparked a national debate on the possible connection between toxic political rhetoric and violence. The attack, which claimed the lives of a federal judge and a 9-year-old girl, shocked the conscience of the country. The assassination attempt targeting Gifford by the apparently mentally unbalanced 22-year-old Loeffner may or may not have been directly related to the increasingly bellicose rhetoric of conservative politicians and activist groups like the Tea Party movement and other self-described patriot groups. But the senseless violence in Tucson has caused some to speculate on the effect of extreme right-wing media commentators and politicians who label their political opponents as traitors, communists, and America haters, and the use of gun metaphors. Since the election of Barack Obama, the United States' first African-American president, the Ku Klux Klan, neo-Nazis, and other right-wing organizations have experienced an increase in membership. In April 2009, a government report warned about the rise of extremist groups on the right and the recruitment of U.S. war veterans. Conservative politicians and radio talk show hosts quickly condemned the report, causing Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano to make a public apology. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author Frederick Clarkson, who has written about the religious right and tracked political hate groups for 2 decades. He looks at the toxic political climate in the United States, which he believes has contributed to the increasing danger of domestic terrorism not seen since the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995.
This has got to be a wake-up call. This is the canary dying in the coal mine of American democracy. We have to be aware that this is not a matter, strictly speaking, of right and left, although the violent ideology and rhetoric and actions come overwhelmingly from the right. This is a wake-up call about where we are as a society right now, and we have to look at it through that lens. If there are helpless people out there who are finding political ideas whose expression leads to walking up to a member of Congress at a supermarket and shooting them in the head, we have a problem.
Fred, what have you observed since the 2008 presidential election in terms of an escalation of the caustic and toxic rhetoric that seems to be ever more politically acceptable in mainstream circles and in our news media? What have you noticed about that?
Well, I probably noticed something a little different than what most people notice. Most of what we'll hear is that there's an escalation in the rhetoric and the violent suggestions, whether it's the sniper-scoped targets on Sarah Palin's website aimed at congressional Democratic districts, or the racial edge, and to a lot of commentary, or the birtherism, and all that stuff. All that stuff is true, and that's part of the context. I'm not sure it's different, but I'm not sure it's any worse than what we saw in the 90s with Bill Clinton, although with a black president, it's obviously a bit different. What strikes me most about it is 2 things. One is the ineptitude of the response for most of the rest of America. Journalists, progressive political activists, Democratic political leaders, you name it. We're not very good at figuring out how to respond to this stuff, and we're bullied into silence. The other thing that we are is too accepting of false framing, and that in the sense of false equivalence. Democratic political leaders and pundits will go on television and say, you know, there are extremists on both sides, as if that was the end of the story. It's a thought stopper. It's a conversation stopper. It doesn't allow us to actually talk seriously about what's going on, because the inciting to violence kind of rhetoric that we hear on talk radio and elsewhere, it's not just about the words, it's about the ideas behind them. And there are people who take those ideas seriously. They really believe that the American government is becoming tyrannical. And they really believe that the feds are going to come and take their guns. And they really believe that Jewish bankers are running everything. And those ideas are virulent and a threat to democracy. And unless we can get past to this idea of the false equivalence, we can't even begin to have the conversation about them.
Frederick, as you gauge the danger from the belief system that's sort of exhibited for us in the rhetoric, what do you think the response should be? What do you think we need to do as a people to confront an ideology which describes their own government as the enemy?
Well, one thing, we need to ask our political leaders to recognize that the problem is different than what they're describing, and as well as our news media. Say, look, this is not just a matter of violent rhetoric versus civility. It's not just a matter of words. And we have to ask ourselves and the people who we relate to and the people who we look to for political leadership to treat it differently. We have active ideological pro-violent movements in the United States. Many of them overlap. We've talked on your show many times about anti-abortion violence, for example. The people who are proponents of that are still out there. They're still organizing for it. And they'll find more people who are willing to take that kind of violent action. And these things are not one-day news stories. They're the story of our time.
What role do you think the president should play in all this, given that this has happened on his watch, just as the Oklahoma City bombing happened on Bill Clinton's watch? And he did confront it vigorously, attacking the toxic rhetoric that he believed and many others believed fomented the rise of the militia movements that were part and parcel of that attack on the federal building in Oklahoma City.
Well, he did. And I might add that the first significant interagency task forces to investigate anti-abortion violence happened under his watch, and that of Janet Reno as Attorney General as well. I think we need to call on the president to be more vigorous in saying that his standards of civility need to be upheld. And the way that you do it is to call out those who are being uncivil. It's not civil to ignore threats and violence. It's a betrayal of civility. And when the president and the people who think like him, and a good many people inside the Beltway do, will say that, well, there are extremists on both sides, they need to be called out on that, saying that that is a lie, at least in the sense that they mean it. There's no overt violence and threats of violence and ideologies of violence coming out of the liberal left, and certainly not out of any element of the Democratic Party that I'm aware of. If there are some exceptions, I'll believe that. But let's see the evidence. Let's see the facts. Let's see the crimes. Show us the people and the organizations that you claim are out there. And if you can't show us the facts, then you need to apologize for your failure of leadership. And I would say that to President Obama.
That was journalist Frederick Clarkson, editor of the book Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America. Read his articles online at talktoaction.org. January 12th marked the first anniversary of the earthquake that leveled Port-au-Prince, Haiti, killing an estimated 230,000 people and largely decapitating the government, devastating the city's already crumbling infrastructure, and hobbling the work of many international aid groups. Haiti has 10,000 nonprofit aid organizations, ranging from major players like Doctors Without Borders and Save the Children to tiny storefront church operations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sherman Malone, co-founder 16 years ago of Haiti MeriCare, a Connecticut-based group serving the health and education needs of residents of the small fishing village of Jacques Seal on Haiti's northeast coast, as well as in a poor Port-au-Prince neighborhood. The organization works in collaboration with local Haitians and the government's Ministry of Health and Education. Malone, who traveled to Haiti on the earthquake's grim anniversary and amid a disputed presidential election, talks about the impact the earthquake and subsequent cholera epidemic have had on both the rural and urban populations, and how the world can provide assistance to better help Haiti recover.
Many people came as refugees from the city. They came back to extended family in the countryside, not only, of course, in my village, but throughout rural Haiti, which created a very difficult situation because often the people from the city were the better-off members of the family. Like the story of the city mouse and the country mouse, they were coming to the country to ask help from cousins, aunts, uncles, extended family, who were just subsistence farmers, barely managing on their own, so that the people who took them in had to make very great sacrifices to do so. At the same time, when cholera gripped the country, it started in the Artibonite, in the rice bowl section of Haiti, in the middle toward the west. and then spread rapidly to Port-au-Prince as people traveled to the capital city. Then, little by little, it began to spread to the farther countryside. There were three deaths before the community was shocked enough to realize how very valuable the information about cholera prevention was. And they immediately, leaders sprang up to assist the staff of the clinic and the Ministry of Health Northeast, informing people about what to do.
Sherman Malone, your organization also works in Port-au-Prince. What happened there, and what's happened over the past year?
In the capital of Port-au-Prince, Haiti Maricare has for some 16 years supported a preschool primary school that serves 200 children. Immediately after the earthquake, the school was badly damaged, and the well at the school was damaged. And our first action was to repair that well, which made it possible for a manual hand-pumped well to provide the only water that was available in this neighborhood to about 250 people who were camped on the ground near the school in the days following the earthquake. Food distribution tended to be unfair because the biggest, strongest people would get the most of it. There have been improvements in aid organizations recognizing community leadership. I think that Venezuela in particular was in the leadership in that way. They offered food to people who had organized themselves in the camps, and they went and monitored how the food was distributed to see that it got to children and women and elderly and frail in a fair way. We were able to open for school in March and have consistently stayed open and have stayed in touch with this group that started at 250, and gradually some have found places in the official camps and some have gone to the countryside to relatives, and they're now about 50 people who really have no place to go. They have to move from place to place, either because the rain drives them out or because the owners of those places can't afford to give them a welcome anymore since the earthquake. And they're suffering very much. There was a recent program where it was noted that Haiti needs, what this person said was, less charity and more justice. Haiti needs lots more justice. But from my view, Haiti also needs a huge amount of ongoing material help and the advocacy to hold not only the nonprofit, non-governmental organizations responsible, but also our own government, and particularly former President Clinton, who's leading the agency whose responsibility it is, in partnership with the Prime Minister of Haiti, to coordinate services and to make sure that they are used effectively, and that any organization, if it's the USAID or if it's some nonprofit or some little group of church people, anybody who raises money to help Haiti needs to be accountable, not only to the people who donate the money, which is very important, but also to the partners in Haiti, to the Haitian people. Our goal, and the goal of principal assistance for Haiti that really helps, is to sustain some important effort over time, and as the Ministry of Health puts it, respond to the emergency, but not at the cost of the commitment to long-term intervention that helps to solve the long-term problem.
That was Sherman Malone, co-founder of Haiti Maricare. Contact the aid group by calling area code 203-797-1893. Or visit their website at HaitiMaricare.org. In the aftermath of the Democrats' midterm election loss of the House and a weakening of their majority in the Senate, President Obama announced a shakeup in his White House staff during the first week of the new year. William Daley was named Obama's new chief of staff, replacing Rahm Emanuel. Gene Sperling, a key player in the negotiations that extended the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy, will replace Lawrence Summers to become director of the National Economic Council, the same position he held under President Bill Clinton. William Daley, of the famous Chicago political family dynasty, has been an executive at J.P. Morgan Chase, worked for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and served as Commerce Secretary in the Clinton administration. Bill Clinton tapped Daley to win ratification of the controversial NAFTA treaty during his first term. Given Daley's past criticism of Obama's political agenda, it wasn't surprising that Tom Donahue, CEO of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which spent millions of dollars to defeat Democrats in the 2010 election, praised Daley's appointment. Progressives have generally been disappointed by the White House staffing changes, concluding that the president, after the Democrats' election defeat, has decided to move his administration further to the right. The widely held assumption that the U.S. electorate is clamoring for more conservative policies is contradicted by a recent CBS 60 Minutes Vanity Fair poll that found that a strong majority of those surveyed said they favored increasing taxes on the rich and defense cuts over reducing Social Security and Medicare benefits. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with journalist and author David Lindorf, who explains why he believes President Obama is pursuing policies rejected by the American people.
We had this poll which showed, not surprisingly, because people are smart when they are left alone to their own thoughts, three out of five Americans would like, actually more than three out of five Americans would like to see as the primary way of fighting the deficit, taxing the rich. The next largest group of people wanted as their priority for cutting the budget, cutting defense. And the same poll found that only 3% of Americans would want to see Social Security cut, and only 4% would want to see Medicare cut. So then you look at those figures and you say, well, what is the government actually doing? Well, the government, which is run by Democrats still, has been talking about cutting Social Security in the form of raising the retirement age. It's been talking about raising Social Security tax, and it's been talking about cutting Medicare and not taxing the rich. Obama worked out this deal with the Republicans to extend the tax cuts that have been giving the rich a free ride for 8 years under the Bush administration for another 2 years. So you look at that and you say, you know, Americans want one thing. The government's doing the opposite. And with the Republicans, it's even worse. I mean, they're not even close to doing any of these things that the poll says Americans want. So I started looking at some other polls that have been done in the last 2 years, and it's a consistent pattern. You know, one of the more recent polls done by Pew Charitable Trust was that showed that two-thirds of Americans want the war ended. And what are they doing? They're escalating the war. They're adding another 1,400 troops. Obama said would end in 2011, has been extended, so combat is supposedly going to run till 2014 and probably beyond that. They're leaving themselves a window to jump through and stretch it out further. And then you can keep going. There's a poll that showed that two-thirds of Americans want to have something done about global warming and reducing the carbon emissions in the United States, even if, and this was part of the poll, even if it raises energy prices. Well, the government has done nothing to cut carbon emissions. So you just go on and on down these things. It turns out that in every major issue where you ask Americans about where they stand on the important things, they want the progressive stance, and the government is giving them the opposite. So what it shows is we have a completely hollowed out fake democracy. It's a formalistic democracy where people vote every 2 years, maybe, with sometimes great difficulty, with obstacles put in their way. And then the politicians ignore what the people want because they are really owned by the corporations.
With the fact that he's now got a new chief of staff, well, William Daley, you know, part of the Clinton triangulation administration, as well as his stint at Morgan Chase Stanley and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the anti-worker U.S. Chamber of Commerce, as well as Gene Sperling and Robert Gates, of course, a holdover from the Bush administration. Is there any chance progressive forces, the progressive movement, if they organize, can prevent Obama from moving any farther to the right after this midterm election?
No, I think the pattern has been set. This this guy is Clinton 2, basically. It's going to be all about him getting himself reelected, if he can, by pulling himself to the right and undermining the Republican arguments that he's a socialist. He may not succeed in that because there's a lot of racism involved in the opposition to Obama that he'll never overcome. But, you know, that's not for want of trying. And I think what's going to happen is that every single liberal progressive goal is going to be subverted unless people, you know, really resist taking to the streets and so on. I think it's really a done deal that Obama has to be written off by the left.
Dave, one of the big fights coming up, of course, is going to be around Social Security. Obama's deficit commission seems stacked to cut benefits and raise the retirement age and gouge people who really can afford at least. That seems to be the direction that he's headed, as well as the Republicans. This is a big fight coming up, and unions and progressives in general, are they gearing up, in your view, for this fight? Because society, the country as a whole, is going to lose a lot if Social Security's gutted.
The potential is there for a real battle royal because, you know, this is the year that the baby boom generation start to collect Medicare, and next year, because it's 66 for retiring now, they already got us. So, you know, now we're going to start seeing that quadrant, which is going to double the size of the senior lobby. I'm speaking as a person born in 1949, I'm 61. We are going to have an incredible political power as a group. We also have a legacy of street politics. We know how to defend what we believe in. So what we're going to have, I think, happen is we're going to see the senior lobby turn into a much more militant and much more powerful force than anything that we've seen before. So I'm actually fairly optimistic that this can be beaten, and not only that, this can become kind of the focus for organizing around progressive issues of all kinds.
That was investigative journalist David Lindorf, co-author of the book The Case for Impeachment. Read his columns online at thiscan'tbehappening.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.